270.
All right, let's talk about
minute.
Remember what happened last week?
Right? Yep.
Ruined the great Kiddush Hashem that was performed by Elisha. Compare it to the following, if I may. Can you imagine, I mean, this occasionally happens, whatever, but let's say there was a family who lost an old grandmother. And they really went, I would say, beyond the call of duty. I did a tremendous amount of things for them, and I really worked things through for them. Everything was made settled and on many different directions. And they came, wrote this more beautiful card, and I said, they just, you know, they told everyone who came to pay a shiva call, what a wonderful thing. Imagine after the shiva is over, if I go over there and I present them with a bill. That'll be $1,000, please. He says, what? He says, yeah, I did stuff for you, come on. I've itemized this call is for $2, this trip I took for you is $27, this service I did for you is $250. Imagine such a thing. I would go and do that. Or even if I would send a messenger to do that, get a bill from the shul, his services. So imagine how disgusting that would be, right?
It's crazy.
Right.
Now, if Naaman in this case actually offered at first, right?
Yeah,
and then Elisha said, no.
He did the right thing,
God.
Elisha.
It's
right.
God who did it. Now look, Elisha, a prophet has to live. A prophet has to, you know, that is, you know, it's interesting that when Amos gave bad prophecies to Israel for the future because they were acting in a bad way, right? So the people said to him, why don't you go to a different place, give them some good prophecies, and eat bread there? Implying that the bad prophets, now I'm saying the really bad prophets who were not speaking from God, just made a living out of telling the people what they wanted to hear. And they got paid for it. Right? You don't tell people who are Mechalei Shabbos, yeah, it's fine, you're doing fine, just you know. The whole purpose of a prophet is to get people to improve themselves, right? But people don't like to hear that. They like to hear that my behavior is quite good, my behavior is quite acceptable, I don't need any improvement, right? Usually the people who like to hear mussar are the people who don't really need it. The people who need it don't like to hear it, right? So we see from these psukim that prophets used to be paid for the prophecy, and the better the prophecy, the more you like to be likely to be paid, right? When Shaul wanted to get news about the donkeys, remember he said, we can't go to ask Shmuel where the donkeys are. Why did he say that? Because a prophet isn't going to concern himself with our particular needs? Why not? A prophet is concerned with every Jew's need. Why can't we go to ask Shmuel about our donkeys, remember?
Do we have enough money?
We have no money. How can we go and ask a prophet? We have no money. Now, today you go to visit a Rebbe for a bracha. Usually you leave him something, right? Get a little pigeon.
Okay.
Here's where I draw the line. A Rebbe who charges is not a Rebbe.
No, he's not charging. You give him voluntarily.
Voluntarily accepts it, fair enough. Had Elisha accepted it at first, he might have been a little wary. You offered it. Elisha said, no, I didn't do this. God did it. So when the Gehazi comes and asks for the money afterwards, my master changed his mind. And we discussed last week how Gehazi thought he could get away with it. Elisha's here performing miracles all over the place every Monday and Thursday, and you think that you're going to get away with it. The minute he came home, Elisha said, what do you think? Are you crazy? How did you think it? Because in last week's Haftorah, remember that we read the week before, somehow Elisha did not know why that woman came. He didn't know that the woman's son died. So Gehazi, oh, my master's slipping. Maybe I can slip one by him also, right?
Yeah.
So when he comes back, Naaman just looks at him as another two-bit prophet who gets paid. You know, that's it. Okay, so the Tanakh continues now with a story, a continuing story, minor ones to be sure at first, about Elisha's prophetic abilities. So remember that we start out, did you start in this direction? We'll go around?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's about 278.
And then the disciples of the prophet behold now the place where we are sitting before you is too narrow for us. Let us go now to the drawing and take from there each man one beam, and let us make a place for ourselves to sit there.
Okay, so they said that we don't have enough place here. Saying what Alicia is going to do, he's going to create space. What are they doing? So let's see what practical advice you can give to someone who doesn't have a big enough apartment.
I'm particularly interested in this.
And one said, please be willing to go with your servants. And he said, I will go.
Okay, Ho'el here, Rashi says, is, he trusts that. Okay? He trusts that. Means, English is good. Let's up. To want to do something. Please, I want you not to just come with us, but I want you to feel the need to come with us. We need you. We can't find a place to live without you. Okay? Remember by Yoel Moshe, Lashevis Isha'ish? What did Rashi write there? By Yoel Moshe, Lashevis Isha'ish. In fact, the famous Satmar book by Yoel Moshe comes from there. Right? It was a play on words because his name is
Moshe.
Moshe, and then his father was Yoel.
Rabbi Yoyish.
So by Yoel Moshe. So, but there it means Moshe wanted to stay with Yisrael. He enjoyed staying with Yisrael. Okay? And then Rashi writes that Vayol is a Lashon Shvua, that Moshe took an oath to remain with Yisrael. That's why he had to ask permission to leave, because of his oath. And that and Rashi there, I'm just telling you this because Rashi proves that it's a Lashon of an oath from this week's Parsha. Okay? And Yitzchak is making a pact with the Plishtim. He says, "Tihi na Allah bein Oseinu b'neinu b'necha b'nechusav risimach." There should be an Allah between us. An Allah is something that no. With all due deference to Rashi, and Allah, but Rashi is correct. I say Allah really means a curse. The reason why, and the Torah is it's right on target to this, because archaeologically we have found all the oaths of the ancient times, the time of the Torah. Every oath has at the end of it. For a curse for the one who doesn't keep it. An oath, always had a curse at the end. Right? We found all these oaths in ancient times of promises to people made, and at the bottom it gives, and this is what happens, this is the curse that happens to the one who. So you see that the word for oath evolved to be a similar word in the Tanakh even for curse. Okay? Allah, Aleph Lamed. Look for it in the, I think it's the fourth Aliyah. Okay. And we want you to go with us. So where did they go?
Hayar Dana the Yig Ziru Ha'eti.
Okay. Feeling them. So he did go with them. Right? He's a man of the people, Elisha. Someone else might have said, no, I'm too busy, I have many meetings, I have busy, an important guy. Right? Any rogue has to balance triage. You can't tell everybody, well, you can't come in, you don't have an appointment. And again, if everyone comes in, which is pretty much what I do, and sometimes you can. Right. So it says, and they went towards the Yarden, towards the Jordan River. By Zeruah came and they started cutting wood. For what?
For a clearing and for a sacrifice.
Okay.
Cut down the trees.
For a clearing to build a place to live. Mm-hmm. Right. Land there. They don't even have to buy it. Just go ahead. Yeah. Okay. Now, really, we must analyze why the Tanakh is telling us this story.
Right.
Because look what's happening here.
And even the wording, go.
Which word?
To go, you know.
Eilechitam?
Like, yeah. Mm-hmm. Just go. Like, lech lecha or something.
Leich, ani eilech, vayelechitam. Well, I think that it is.
Yeah, that's strange, because you know, if they're cutting down trees, they have to go somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like they always say, lach kum, like why does it say lach and kum?
But here, it's to say, it means that he is, I mean, like lech lecha, lech means that he's walking with them. He's not a stagnant person. You know, a great leader usually stays on a you know, stationary place, and people come to him for advice or for instruction. Right? So there is one additional prophet who's like this. It says specifically he would go travel from place to place and help people and give advice to Shmuel HaNavi. There's a tshuva he would return home once in a while, but he's always on the road giving instruction. So here we see that Elisha is this kind of person as well.
Right, but it looks like initially he wasn't going to go, so they had to make a second request. We let it look
so,
at...
Well, at first they said we need to go,
but
you should
let
go.
Us go. Nielcha, no.
Well, they probably didn't give it a second thought. They just probably thought that
he said go.
Go, yeah. This is the
thing. And then he's come with us. Right. Go with us.
Right, his initial plan is clearly not to go.
Yeah, right.
Okay. So while they're chopping wood near the Yarden, supplies the earth with plenty of water. The trees to go very tall. You go to the north near Tel Dan, you see by far and away the tallest trees in Israel, and some of the tallest trees you've ever seen. Unless you've been to California, but there's huge trees. Have you gone to Tel
Where's that?
In the very north
still
of Israel.
Have this,
because there's all these babbling water, so these water waves all the way in the Dan, the Banyas, the Dan, the Yarmouk, and all these biblical waterways. There's beautiful topography from Israel up there.
Mm-hmm.
You see the picture we took last year of that,
yeah.
That like he's standing on this and underneath there's nothing, so it's so scary. You know, as you're walking on it, you can't tell, but when you cross over and you see what you just did, you just walked on this little thin strip of rock, and underneath is 500 feet of nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And you just walked across this little thing. While doing it, you feel all right. There's a fence there, but then you're walking looking from the other side, and you're very scared. So that's where all these waterways are, and the trees grow very tall. So that's why he took them there, because you'll have plenty to chop. Okay. Now you know you're not allowed to chop down fruit trees, but if you need the wood, put right in the tree. Okay, chop down. Mm-hmm. All right. So listen. We'll look what happens to one of them as he's chopping. Okay.
ויהי האחד מתחיל הקורא, והברזל נפל אל המים ויצא, ויאמר, אהה, אני והיא שאול.
Well, you see a certain, just a moral fiber in this pasuk. One was chopping the wood. I'm not sure how it would happen, but he's chopping and chopping, and he takes a stroke, and the metal part flies off, like the Torah spoke about, you know, the city of refuge, and it doesn't hit someone here, but it flies into the water. And says, oh no, my master, this is a borrowed axe. He's not so bothered that he lost it. It's not his axe, though.
Why would it be borrowed?
I don't know how this to be the case. He borrowed it. Shaul borrowed.
They were nubbies, maybe. They just...
the guy said, I borrowed this axe. I'm good. Especially terrible about losing this axe. It's not mine.
Oh, that's what's
okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, Peter, would you what? Yeah,
man. Alei over each elokim anan nafal vayirehu et makom vayitzav each vayishlich shama vayatzef habayzal. English?
Wow.
And the man of God said to him, where did it fall? And he showed him the spot, and he cut off a piece of wood and threw it there, and the axe blade floated.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, some of the other things is chemistry you could understand. But earlier on, the water that was poisoned and he threw salt in it.
Now, Elisha does many miracles. Now, to spend a miracle for this is very strange.
Mm-hmm.
Why wouldn't Elisha just give him a 50 cents and say to buy a new one?
Or he also could have retrieved it anyway. He could have just put out his hand and it could have risen up.
Oh, absolutely. Why would the wood...
So why is it? Yeah, that's
right. Let's try to understand maybe what these things represent.
And how is the wood attracting
the metal?
He
says, pick it up for yourself. Hey, he did stretch out his hand and took it.
Yeah.
is the miracle the point of the story? Wouldn't it be a contrast with the dishonesty of Gehazi coming immediately after it?
The response of the man over losing something borrowed is, you know, some of it, it's not mine anymore. Right? I mean, there are halachos about losing things that you borrow in Sefer Bava Kamma, in Sefer Bava Metzia, in Perkei Mashpi, and in there's certain cases where if the thing is lost or ruined, you don't even have to pay.
Yeah, but you would feel guilty if you borrow something and something happens to it.
Anybody would. Of course, sure you do.
Many people would feel more guilty if it was their own, but here he feels more guilty because it's not mine. All right, so that's one thing. And let's go back to how he it's not quite clear if he took the wood from the axe handle itself. In other words, he put in now this man is just holding a handle. Mm-hmm. That's the blade fellow. So did he take the wood, the handle part, and he just dropped it in the water, and then he put it in the top of the water, and he said, okay, come on up. And it came up and attached itself. Mm-hmm. Reattached itself. I'm really more perplexed with the mode of in which he picked up the blade. We'll try to work it out still. More perplexed with that than that the Bible would tell us. The Bible's very, very parsed. Tale about miracles. Most miracles in the Bible are done in a most natural way. The miracle being that it happens when the person says it will happen. Right? In other words, Moshe could have gone to Paro and use your imagination, please, because whatever we can imagine, I assume God could do. Except make a rock that he can't lift. But whatever we can imagine, and if you can imagine God turning the sky into multicolors, and Moshe could take his staff and point to the sun and say, look at the sun, it's about to turn purple. And it's about to drip, 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 drip into the water. Or take the sun, take your staff and move the sun across the sky. Pointing on his staff all around. See that? Look! And go around and around and pick day, night, day, night, day, night, day. Do that for 2-3 minutes of miracles power, and I assure you that day B'nai Israel will leave. I mean, this must be some things Moshe could have done that day, but God doesn't work that way. How do I know how God works? Don't expect me to explain.
But if he hardened Paro's heart,
there's a bigger picture that we can look at now in retrospect, because I have the Sefer Shmos with my portion. But when it's happening, people might ask, Moshe himself asks at the Ego, what is this journey here? Why don't you just pick us up on those eagle's wings you spoke about and bring us where we have to go? Moshe says, I have a bigger picture that even you don't see right now. No man can see me and live at the time that things are happening. So here you have a note from Abarbanel. This is always the parish I like to give. Maybe read inside right here. He rejects the supposition that the wood had to fit into the axe blade to bring it up. Why would the prophet so restrict himself that the only way to bring up the blade is with the X handle? Why? I mean, it makes sense that that's probably what he did. He threw the handle there and he said, come on up, and reattached itself. Forget about why God would so bend nature like this just for such a relatively minor thing, for goodness sakes. If you're going to do a miracle, why do one for a 59-cent item at the local hardware store? You know what I'm saying? Save a miracle like this
to
solve hunger in a whole country. You know?
Maybe there was a reason he wanted to keep them in line or something.
Alright, well, so what this shows is that Elisha is not only in the big picture, he's also in the small picture. But
even unto the smallest.
Right. Small tale. Someone is hurt because, it's almost like the fact that he said he's Shaul is why he decided to do something about it. If the man didn't care, just my neighbors. No way Elisha does this miracle. He only does this miracle because the man is so bothered by the harm possibly done to his neighbor. Okay. All right, so who says, it is mentioned nowhere in the text that the wood flows up. Rather, the prophet wished to demonstrate that nature has no power of its own. It is merely a tool of God. When he wills it, the light piece of wood can sink and any piece of iron can float. And therefore cast a small piece of wood onto the Jordan and sank to the bottom of the summoning the axe blade to the top. He disagrees as far as how this miracle happened. He said that he took a small piece of wood, not the handle. If you could take an axe handle, even without the blade, put it on top of water, it's going to sink. If you take a small chip of wood, small twig, or something light, and put it on the water, it'll float. What Elisha did was he took a small piece of wood, laid it on the top of the water, and it sank down at the bottom, picked up the blade. Notice another thing. He asked, where did you drop it? Does that wood need to be placed near the... Just drop it any place, and the wood will find it. I mean, if you can... Whoever can do miracle A, you ought to be able to just put the wood in anywhere. Right? That's precisely the point. He wants this small piece of wood to be placed in a similar place so that man can see, look at that. God is making a small piece of wood sink and a heavy piece of iron float. This is all just the tools in God's hands this very special man is using. Okay, at this not tremendously auspicious time. I mean, it's not such an important event. The fact is, it gets in the Bible, for goodness sakes, this small little tiny thing. Again, it's just a 59-cent item. Right? Okay. So he says, Vayomer Haremloch. And then he says, go. There's your ass handle. Vayishlach Yado, Vayikos Yado. He sends forth his hand, and he gets there. It's there. Take it. Very little effort. Elisha has a tremendous command. Okay. All right, let's continue with talking about
this. It's like this little story stuck in here between the story with Naaman. Now we're back to the wars in Aram. Mm-hmm. Right?
The wars continue. That's the real tragedy. Naaman might have put an end to things. He said he's going to become Jewish, he's going to pray to Hashem.
It was very puzzling, this passage.
No, that's a war.
Maybe it's Naaman. Just repeating how the prophecy, or the fact, the strength of Elisha as a prophet, is pointing out.
But that Gehazi did irreparable damage to his reputation by asking for that money. Naaman should have said, what? Elisha really wants the money? What a shame. I had such a different idea of Elisha. So Naaman just took the Lashon Hara. My master changed his mind, he wants the gift. That's Lashon Hara. The worst kind. Okay. Alright, so what's interesting is that if you look at what Elisha complained about mistaking, and he says, is it time to take, and he lists all of these things, is it time to take kesef, the godim, the sim, kramim, tzom, bakar, adim, ushvachas, for goodness sake, you didn't take in all that stuff, right? I would like to compare this to another place in the Bible where Yahushua told people not to take anything from the booty of Yericho, the first water part, right? He said, Yahushua. And someone named Ochan took a few things. And when Yahushua confronts him with it, he says the same thing. Is this the time to engorge yourself with gold, silver, and clothing, and raiments, and there goes on listing money? He just took a few things. The answer is, in both these cases, that the sin is exaggerated and exacerbated simply because in both cases it's such an egregious trespass on really on the whole nation.
Yeah, it's a Hilu Hashem.
And the people on top.
The small one, but it's still...
But it's, but
explain, you know, the way they took everything from Egypt. I know I've read the explanation.
But then you can say, all right, those were wages.
Oh.
Yeah. The Talmud says
reparations, right?
Yeah, reparations.
Reparations.
You're not kidding. The Talmud says that that Alexander the Great had a delegation from Egypt to say that the Jews owe us all this money with interest from what they took from us. And he allowed the Jews to respond. They said, those are wages.
Mm-hmm. It's just like Holocaust restitution now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but really, that was the precedent. I agree with that thesis, because let's say somebody has a housekeeper, and housekeeper works, and she thinks she's underpaid, asks for a raise, doesn't get the raise, so she steals something. It's still
okay,
wrong.
First of all, Israel didn't steal. They asked for these things. Right, so I would say, it's not just, you know, in the Holocaust you can say it's restitution, you know, even if they didn't steal anything per se from you, or even doing forced labor or something. Forced labor, you know, they show, you know, show proof.
Mm-hmm.
They stole everything from these people.
No, I understand. They stole their homes, they stole their lives,
and
they stole their relatives.
And the clothing and
right.
back.
You know, the insurance companies didn't pay up,
right.
The banks held back funds.
Right, so but here, they sold the obvious for all these years. Now, look, there are many differences here at hand between who was the aggrieved party, who was making payment for the party. But the Jews leaving with gold and silver from Egypt, is this something which we should be proud of, which we should prefer not to have? Yeah, they made a golden calf from all that. You know, and Rashi says that Moshe preferred that they don't take all that gold and silver. They only took the gold and silver because God begged Moshe. Please, I beg of you, Moshe. I know you're not inclined to do this, but I told Avraham Avinu. So everyone asked him. It's a Gemara in the Sefer Brachos. Rashi brings it down. Does Hashem have to keep his promise? Because if he doesn't, Avraham will be upset. Doesn't Hashem have to keep his promise? Just because that's the right thing for someone like Hashem to do. And you keep your promise. He told Avraham, "I'll give you descendants, great rechush." So you have to keep your promise, regardless of whether Avraham would complain or not. Now, the Gemara says, but Avraham will say, you kept your promise to make my descendants slaves, but you didn't keep your promise. So there's a commentary to Rashi that answered this question. It's based on Ibn Ezra even. Is that when Hashem told Avraham, "I'm going to give you descendants of Rechush Gadol after they leave slavery," you know what Hashem meant?
Other kinds of treasures.
Torah, Ed Lid of Israel, maybe. But Avram thought it's money. So that's why I have to keep Avram happy, because if Avram thinks it's money, okay, I have to give him money. But I merely meant the Torah. Right? I mean, I like Avram's shot, because they did not leave Egypt with the Torah. They didn't leave Egypt with Israel. And Yetzu Mitzrayim B'chush Gadol. All right. I can read it loosely, maybe. Anyway, I don't really think it's in the same league. If they're going into Israel now and they're starting new, I'd like them to have some wages to pay, and have a little currency. It'll give them a good start. Right? Never mind that they made an egel out of it, but the Derech Tzachos, if I can say. The whole thing comes because God begs Moshe. That's the Pasuk says. God doesn't usually beg, God commands. God doesn't say, "I beg of you, not on Pesach." It's called a mitzvah because it's a tzivui. I'm a slave, and I'm not interested in how the slave feels about what emotional feeling I get about serving the master. It's good because I know the master likes that, but I just want to know how am I serving the master today, right? So what I do and what I don't do, and it's wonderful that master wants me to have a good relationship with my children, with my parents, with other people, and stuff. Beautiful, it's a beautiful thing. But the whole thing hinges on this. Please, Moshe, I beg of you, get money for my descendants. For Avram's descendants, because it's only right that after all that work they should have money, right? So later on, when Bnei Yisrael made the Egel, Moshe said, "God, if you don't forgive them, Mecheni no mesifrecha, erase me from your book." So there are tzachos. I don't know if it's long ago, and I saw that Mecheni no mesifrecha means get the na out of your request that they should have money, because if you didn't say no back there, I would have been against it. If you didn't plead with me, I would have said, let's get out of Egypt with our skin, and who needs the money? But since you said no, you made me get the money. So get the no out of the Torah there, and I would
no problem.
Erase the no from your book, and they wouldn't have had money anyway to make into a golden calf. And then the metaphor is, of course, that Jews have throughout the ages made golden calves out of their money. I call it the Long Islandization of American Jews. I'm not kidding. Jews moved out to Long Island too soon. They moved to the suburbs too soon before they built shuls there and built schools there. So what happened? You had Jews who wanted to go to shul on Shabbos. They became wealthy. They moved out in the Lower East Side, and they moved to Long Island. Right? They moved to the suburbs. What should you make sure? What does any Jew today? Let's say you feel my apartment is small. It's time for me to move. Where are you going to move?
Near
Jewish community, the pizza store,
Chinese
is very important. So what they did was they moved in 1950 to neighborhoods where there was no school. No. So they said this school kids the public school. They might have sent it to yeshiva if there was one around. And then the death knell was a tshuva in 1951, an official tshuva to the conservative movement. Is it better to drive to shul on Shabbos and go to shul? The shul is 20 miles away. Or is it better to not go to shul? On the psak, the official conservative psak was better to drive to shul. These were people who could have gone to mikveh. These are people who, if it was there, these are people who could have kept kosher if there was a kosher butcher store in the neighborhood. How long is it going to be when people are driving to shul on Shabbos before they're watching TV on Shabbos, before they're not eating chametz on a day set? Before, so if it was a few years, by 1958 today.
I mean, Mahal Shabbos is the ikur.
Yeah, once they're driving on Shabbos, then soon they're going to be riding on Shabbos, soon they're going to be spending money, so they're going to ride, not driving, just driving to shul on Shabbos, driving to the mall on Shabbos, and that's what it was. So what is it? They made a golden calf with their money. They got wealthy enough to move out, and that's what they did. So this is a constant thing. Okay, so let's go back to it.
A constant happening.
Yes.
Right? Happens all the time.
Just a different. I had, after we went through the story with Gehazi last week, I was thinking his conduct. So it reminds me the image of the non-Jew towards the Jew is the kind of the money grubber.
There you go. What is
so, and it takes one person to create that. You know, can do so much harm.
Yes.
We're so much good.
It's there's a Gemara that says that the deacon loves their money more than their own body. I said, no, it's not disgusting. A Russia loves his body much more than his money. How do I know? Because he spends all his money on his own body, satisfying himself. A tzaddik loves his money much more, because a tzaddik knows that his money is stuck this hospital, and I know what value money has. And the Gemara just explains it very simply, because when you really are scrupulous about how you make your money, and you're scrupulous about how you spend it, and you're scrupulous about, you know, we do have a reputation for doing well. We bring prosperity wherever we go.
I've
said this in drushes. I always like when it says that he vayichan es pnei ha'ir. Beautiful Rashi picks up on it that Yaakov moved into a new place, and he immediately showed this place the three different shatim. He says he's misaking matbeos, he made currency, he misaking shvakos, he made commerce.
I thought that was crossed over to get his items.
Oh, right.
Unimportant thing.
That was the pachim katan, little jars. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now she rests there because he was.
He worked hard for it.
He worked hard for it. So, you know,
as you come, as you go.
Okay. All right, so let's see that the war with Aram continues because of that unfortunate event and that unfortunate reputation that we get as a result. Right? Actually, someone just wrote an article I did in the Harvard Law Review. He has my opinion about it. His article was arguing that we should be able to purchase organs and donate organs for money.
I heard something about that.
It's unethical.
So what's the unethical line is?
The poor wouldn't have access.
A slippery slope, and you never know. You know, some of those old novels about, you know, body parts being slipped.
Mm-hmm.
That's a little bit about talking about organs of someone. Nebuch, you know, it's called donate an organ, right?
I don't know. Jews and
non-Jews.
Jews
and non-Jews. In other words, can I go to a hospital and say, I want to donate one kidney, not to anyone in particular, but it's $2,000, and I'd like to get paid for it. There's not much you can donate in your lifetime.
Right.
A kidney you can. A
kidney you can. And certainly if someone wants to donate his eyes in his lifetime, he can too. He just won't see afterwards. A kidney, you only need one kidney.
You can donate after you die somewhere.
Oh, yes, that's a halacha contract. Exactly. Absolutely. Yes, so should a family be paid money for these things and make it more... Say someone is, someone just got into a car crash. The kidneys and eyes you can use for a while, but other organs have to be demolished right away. This is why that's a controversy, because it's a question about what's the Jewish position about when death occurs. You can't kill someone to take these things. But let's say so they have a poor family, and they can make $6,000-$7,000, but this person, maybe it will be an easier thing. What the argument was, and he asked me to comment. The argument was that, you know what, we're interested in here in saving lives. Do you know how many hundreds and hundreds of people, the number is maybe, I think about 2,000 a year, in Israel die every year waiting for organs? Because in Israel, it's all Jews, Jews don't generally do these things. Right? The argument is that we should try to do anything we can to spur more people to donate these things. There's someone here in the show who's donated a kidney and a liver at the same time. She's still alive 2 years later.
How could you give a liver and live?
Someone who just died a liver, and the liver regenerates itself. But you can't live without it, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And she had no kidneys at the time, and no working kidneys, and she got one, and she's still in Baruch Hashem.
There's a problem. It could be like a market for it, and it could turn out that people can't pay for it in countries that are very poor, stealing organs, and it could be.
Correct. So that's why I warned him. I said, if Jews come out on this, we already have a reputation, pound of flesh, and
invent everything.
Yeah, in economics. The pound of flesh, you know, there are real stories in the ancient world about, it started in about 1600 when Magellan circumnavigated the world. There were two people who, doubted it and said, I'll give you a pound of my flesh if you document this story that appeared before Shakespeare. Shakespeare just heard the story and said, oh, let me put it on a Jew who says it. Right,
that has to be true.
He never saw a Jew in his life.
Yeah. So we have to be very careful how that reputation works.
And what about the blood that we drink? Same thing.
Well, no, that just shows that you can try all you want, and they're still going to tell stories about us. But in this case, I think the dog is a very slippery slope. His concern, he runs a program called Hebrew Organ Donation, Halachic Organ Donation Society. He's the one who wrote the article. And the argument is that he gave the four or five things that people are going to say it is, right? And all the reasons why not. And he said, but all these pale in comparison with these thousands of people who are dying every year waiting for an organ. In Israel alone, it's about 2,000 people. Imagine what it is in a big country like this. So if more people are there and really get this awareness out there, more people are there and donate these things. Now, I agree with you 100%. It would be tremendously immoral to go to, to try to convince this... there are countries in the world where they send suicide bombs for other people.
Mm-hmm.
To tell a 65-year-old man who is, very depressed, you know what? You're thinking of ending it all. Why don't you just give six or seven of your organs? Just end it, tell them to give you a shot, and we'll harvest your healthy organs and let six or seven people live, right? No one's going there, but we're just saying that plus there was a study made at Brown University about 30 years ago about, it's called Lifeboat Ethics. The study's called The Lottery, which imagines the following thing.
Shirley Jackson. Yeah. Oh,
that was that story. And Coma. Do you read Coma?
Yes. In fact, I saw it. I remember seeing the movie actually as a child. Mm. Very scary. Yeah, it's a movie about buying body parts.
No, you keep them floating. You freeze them.
There actually was a Jewish woman whose skeleton was lying at a funeral home in Esther. And apparently this funeral home was related to some physician in New Jersey.
Oh, yeah.
Did you read about it? Yeah. And they harvested her
lymph.
Without her family's permission.
Good to hear about that.
What did after you die? I mean, that's some rabbi saying you can from other.
Well, it depends on. Everybody says you can for the heart, the kidneys and the eyes.
But you may not touch a mace. You may not touch a mace. How can you give?
To save someone else, you're allowed to do anything.
Okay.
The question of the other organs is that they deteriorate very quickly after the person's dead. So it's very possible that what we have to do is halakhically kill the person in order to make it, even though he's very near death, you have to wait too long usually for halakhically. But now people are coming out against it. You know, from a Templar, or Salvatore, or Aaron Salvatore, you know that whole.
I think tenderness,
whether it's brain death or respiration, it determines. Anyway, let me get back to this. This is getting a little overboard here. But the point is that we have to be very careful with the reputation that you get, even as they're trying to save lives. To the bottom line of his argument was, we have thousands of lives to save. Thousands, if we make it more possible for people to donate, to be paid for doing this. Now, some people can be saved from kidneys, you know, dialysis, but still, I'm sure you've heard cases because the donation has to be done from someone with a similar body type, that brothers will give, a friend will give, you see these things.
Of course, you want
to do it to my brother's going to be in much bigger trouble than I would be without my one kidney. Hashem created us not only needing one kidney, but then if you have a problem with that one, then you're in trouble. If you have two and you have a problem with one, then the other one is going to take over. Right? You have a totally non-functioning one kidney in your body, and it's fine. So that's the question here. And there's a real big tangent on this about the Kechil Hashem created by Kechazi in the eyes of the Arameans, which made the war continue. Right? Okay, that's you know, the caricature of the Jew sitting on top of a big money bag, you know, a big fat Jew, and you know. I mean, studies show across the country that we are the most generous group, besides Mormons, I think, but the most generous group in the country as far as tzedakah, and we take care of our own. And, I mean, Dickens?
Just saw it last.
You know what, or maybe it was Tolstoy.
Oliver Twist.
Oh, because then he wrote a story afterwards, very, very complimentary for Jews.
Really?
Yeah, I can't remember the name of it. But he said that they take care of their own. I remember that part of his essay was that they look after each other, and they, you know, I mean, look, I don't have to teach this group here what a Kiddush Hashem is.
I just want to say one thing. The reason why some rabbis should not give organs after you die is because they might have to come kill them while they're still alive because the organs die too quickly. It's not because of resurrection of the dead and the body has to be
right. Back. If someone is able to save, we know we're saving a life with this,
right?
Then you're mitzvah to do it. There's still some people who think that now I won't rise to success mace in the same way. Those sources are really
It's not really.
Yeah, it's not.
Okay.
The rise to the kid in success mace, even if you're blind and missing both legs, you're going to rise to success mace.
Some people are going to rise to success mace.
But I have somebody asking me this question.
Melech Aram Leon Yom Kham B'Yisrael.
Those are all people who are questions. I can have a lot of children.
It's the only time the word Plony Amoni appears in the Tanakh except Rus.
Except what?
Plony Amoni.
Now usually you mean it to refer to something, you know. Some unknown person, so-and-so, John Doe.
Yeah.
But the fact is, Plomi, Pella, means a hidden place.
It's a niflot. Pele is a miracle because it's usually a wonder, something hidden, misunderstood, unknown. And Almoni, Elaine, comes in the word to be dumb. Right? Not Almoni, I mean, unknown, hidden. Same kind of
a widower?
I'm not sure. It would appear to be that there is something from the word Elaine, but I'm not prepared to really establish more. That would be so. Okay. In other words, as all my questions say, Makam Ne'alam. Let's go and hide and camp in a place. Mm-hmm. We'll be able to make a surprise attack against the Jews. Okay. Mishlach Isha Elohim El Melech Yisrael Emor. Hishamer Me'abor HaMakom HaZek Hisham Aram Nechitim. Very careful. Don't go to that place. The Arameans are camped there. Okay.
And the king of Israel sent to the place concerning which the man of God had told him and cautioned him, and he took precautions there, not once and not twice.
Interesting thing. You hear people say not once and twice means more than once or twice. Not a few times, many times.
And the king of Aram was greatly disturbed about this matter, and he summoned his servants and said to them, "Will you not tell me who of ours reveals my secrets to the king of Israel?" And one of his servants said, "No, my master, the king, but Elisha the prophet, who is in Israel, tells the king of Israel the words that you speak in your bedroom."
Amazing. I mean, he says, how is it that every time I come up with a strategy,
at least you know.
The Jews know what's going on? But there's no spy in our camp. It's Elisha, he's on everything. I'm still not sure why he didn't know what was on that woman's mind that time. Mm-hmm. But still, he's able to tell his king and his generals everything, no matter where you say, is that your place bugged.
What?
Okay.
Why in Tet and Yud is it he's... Elisha's referred to as the man of God, so you could say, who is it? And then you find out later that it's
right.
Elisha.
Yeah.
Well,
emphasizing.
I don't expect an Aramean to refer to as the man of God.
No.
Right.
That is a little puzzling.
This is the same Elisha who helped Naaman. He knows everything. So why not make peace with these people?
ויאמר לכו וראו איכל הוא ואשלח וכחהו ויגד לו לאמר הנה בדלתם.
He's going to come to us, and what are we going to do with him? Try to make him a better offer? Get him on our side? You should know that in ancient time there was armies had these occupations that they called the professional cursers. Curse the other side. I don't know. Curse the other side. Bless this side.
Professional curses?
Yeah. And, you know, it's just people who weren't involved in the battle at all.
Was it training
coming
for that?
Out the sides. Yeah, probably. And if you got lucky the first two times, you could command, you know, a huge bounty every time you go to the battle. Really sure.
This is very unrelated, but you give more. It sounds a lot like the pasuk when Yosef is looking for his brothers, and he meets a guy in the field and says, "Hey, you see my brothers?" Like I always think, like, oh, that every guy in every field knows, you know.
You are saying something amazing.
But like, says, "Oh, here he is in Dothan." It's like just the same thing. Have you seen them there in Dothan?
You know, that was the same
place. Right. So it's the same. It's like a parallel.
The mom's the same
right,
place.
So it's like a parallel, and it's just weird that like you don't see these things. You know, I know in Tanakh when there's repetition. Repetition is supposed to teach something.
Absolutely. Because it's not just that's what you were just coincidentally saying.
No, but it's exactly.
It was in Dothan. That's what Yosef was.
Does, right. In the field in Dothan, right?
So I don't know if there's any connection there.
Let's read the story and then.
Yeah,
that's
what I
wonder. Okay. So we shlach shama. Okay. And I just have a little prayer. Okay.
Yudalad, Vayishlach Shama Susim, Verechev Vachayil Kaved, Vayavou Laila, Vayakifu Al Ha'ir. And the man, and he sent three horses and chariots and a great army, and they came at night and surrounded the city. Bhutan is now an ear, a city.
Okay. So they're coming around the entire city. And his Elisha has a Misharis. Elisha used to be the Misharis of Eliyahu. So he's got a Misharis himself. Yeshkin Misharis Yisholokim Lakum. He got up to get up. But he said, Vinei Chayel Sovele Sa'ir Vesus Verachav. There are... He says, bring him to me. Mikhail Amanam, I don't make him know if he can't refuse. There was a whole contingent of the whole battlement surrounding the whole city with horses and chariots. And he said, what are we going to do? Never fear, Kirill, with Elisha. Pasuk Tazayim, we are Al Tiraki, Rabbi Masheri Tani Masheri Tani, because we have more people than they have. We're just two people. Now, Dusan is a city, so there might be more people there, but look at, I mean, Elisha is amazing. Vayispalel Elisha Vayomar. He prayed and said, Hashem, Pekatma Zeinav Yireh, open up the lad's eyes and let him see what everyone else can see. If Kach Hashem is in Ehanar, Bayar, Binei, Aram, Aleisu Simbarecha, Reish Tzigol, Elisha. And he saw that the mountain was full of horses and chariots made of fire. Looks like Eliyahu all around Elisha. Okay. So, Yehudah loved his father Elisha. Hashem Yomar Hachna is Hagoy Hazeb Sanderim. They came to Sanderim to bar Elisha. And they went down to where the people were. And Elisha now prayed and said, God, smite them with blindness. And God smote them with blindness, as Elisha had said. Wow. Let's see. I think it's getting off too much for us ourselves right here. We're going to have to finish next time, but throw us this right down the pasuk of the test here, okay? And we're going to continue with
19, right? 19.
And we're going to continue with how Elisha sort of
in the middle of a great story
just brought them along on this called a wild goose chase almost about finding Elisha. Come, let me show you how to, where to find Elisha so you can take him to your king. Right. Now Elisha might have a golden opportunity here. If the king thinks that he knows everything that's being said, even in, the in his bedroom, the king's not going to just want to kill someone like this.
Use him.
That's where they can use him. Right. Let's see what happens to Elisha. And Elisha understands this and says, you know, I'll go there. God won't let him kill me. Elisha's not worried about going there. That's not in his best interest to kill. Why didn't Paro just kill Moshe and Aaron? When they came in to say, if you don't let him go, and by tomorrow, this place is going to be crawling with frogs. Why didn't you just say, don't, not even 10 seconds from now, right now, take the sights off their heads, right? There were soldiers all over the place. Why didn't you, Moshe and Aaron came in unarmed. Why didn't Paro just kill him?
He's afraid of the towns.
So Barbanel asked that question. He says, because Hashem didn't let him do it. So the Medrash said that they always came in with lions. Medrash is like baffled also. How did Paro not just, don't they give you orders? Kill him already. So actually, in the movie, The Ten Commandments, which has a lot of Narishkeit in it, and the movie seems to answer the same question. It says, well, someone picks up a sword and says to Paro, let me just slice his head off right here on the spot. You don't have to listen to this. And Paro says, no, we'll make a martyr of him before his people. Just let them all go on ranting just before he turned up and blew up the water. So, here too, Elisha is not concerned that either because Hashem is looking out for me, this is Hashkacha Pratis, or because it's against his better interest to kill me. Let me see if he'll make a move on me, and maybe I can make a move on him and convince him to stop this battle. Things are going to get very bad. You see, Elisha might want to stop the battle because battles aren't good for us. We don't like people to fight wars against us. But the Jews in Shomron have become so wicked that Aram is about to turn into a huge rod in God's hand, a rod of wrath in God's hand to punish these wayward people. have to keep that in mind. You know, Hashem sometimes chooses to appear weak because of our deeds. That's how we're different than the ancients. And the Moabite thinks that his God really got weak, and that's why he can't defeat the Ammonites. I better feed him more. The Moabites, my God gets stronger. Mahavdil is not so different. You know, God chooses to be destroys his own temple because of our sin. He's still God. And the proof is, here we are, are we still here? In the Haftorah, this week's Haftorah, what a coincidence. This week's Haftorah is about the Jews saying, how is our God different than these other nations? We destroyed, they were destroyed. And Malachi says, yeah, but they're not building back. You are. Here we are, here's proof. Maybe our God has been made weak by the Korban. We don't have a base mitzvah to offer Korbanos to, maybe he's weak. Right? And he says, no. God is always just as strong. He destroyed his own temple, like he did in Shiloh. His sanctuary back then, right? So we keep an eye on that in the Haftorah between Edom and Israel, about the difference between the destruction of the other nations and our destruction. Okay.
Thank you. Thank you so much.